Good morning, everyone. I'm trying to wake you all up. Just kidding. Looks like you're all bright and alert and ready to go. So are we. This is the February 8th, 2014 meeting of the Fish and Wildlife Commission. Welcome, everyone. Thanks for coming out. We have short agenda for this morning's session, but an important one to all of you. We realize that, so we want to get right to it. The first item on our morning agenda is open public input, and we have a number of people who've signed up. I'll review the rules again so that they're fresh in your mind. The commission allows 3 minutes per person. We'd like you to come to the front table, speak about a few inches from the mic, and listen for the beeping noise. When you hear that beeping noise, that means your time is up. We'd like you to conclude your remarks. Okay, I'll call you up two at a time. Alan Hollingsworth and Bob Late. Okay, Mr. Hollingsworth.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Commission members. I just have a couple comments to make. The last meeting when we testified on the Grays Harbor plan, and then the commission made their input, we was testifying on the January or the December meeting stuff. What I think should be done from now on is the commission present their plan, and then the public testimony comments on that present public plan instead of the last month's public plan. That's one thing I want to make. And after 2014 commercial season, I think this plan should be reviewed and should be reviewed every year. I don't agree with the plan on the commercial side. I haven't seen any input in what I have saw of the plans, the draft plans so far, that has had any input from the commercial side. The small percentages of Chinook allowed in the two areas is so small that it will not provide a significant coho fishery for the commercials. And that's it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Melanie Rabaglia. Okay, Mr. Lake.
My name is Bob Lake. I am on the Grays Harbor on the Grays Harbor policy plan as an advisor, and also I'm involved with regional enhancement groups and such, and also Willapa Bay Gill Hunters. The questions I've got is pertaining kind of what Alan just spoke to, and I think it'd be a good year to review. After every year, we need to review the whole policy as an ongoing stipulation. And also, remember, we need to keep the hump tulips and the Chehalis sides totally separate because there's altogether different effects. And also, I've got a question. We talked about this about a year ago, Chairman Wecker, and that was the safe zones. The Columbia River right now is in dire straits. The Oregon side has not raised Chinook salmon for a good number of years. Washington hasn't either. Let me ask this question. What is anybody going to fish on the Columbia River after this year? Because I don't think there's any fish coming back that are marked, or very few. So how could you generate any fisheries, whether they're recreational or commercial? And the other comment I got, I hope that the commission views the laws of the state of Washington and upholds those laws. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Robert Rao, come forward, please. Ms. Rabaglia.
Hi. The Chehalis River policy comment period has ended, and today you guys will decide on the fate of our salmon. I and others have made our comments, and I do believe that you've read them all. I know that you're on a timetable, and most likely it'll be approved as presented in January the 14th distribution. Overall, the outcome is good. The 2014 policy is a good first step. Plus, a large group of recreational anglers came out together and showed your passion for protecting this resource, for the future, for their lifestyle. It's not their intent to be disruptive. It's just that some folks don't have the nerves to speak before you folks, the panel, and they know others can say it for them. So they cheer and they say, yes, they would have said that too. I intend to stay involved, and I believe that others will too. We speak for the fish. It's that important. Help us keep the salmon, please. Keep information coming. Public input, meetings for the updates to this policy. I agree with Alan. I think this should keep going, but not necessarily the direction he's talking. I'm talking the direction of no more gill netting. How about let's start with no more gill netting in Area 2A? Food for thought. Keep the information coming. Keep these public input meetings going. Keep updates to this policy and the larger issue of setting the salmon seasons with the North of Falcon process. We want to know. We want to get involved. We want to fix this mess that we're all in, all of us, and the fish. I know this will take time, many years' time. This is the first step of many. Thank you for your time. Thank you for going the right direction with us. I understand the game. Have a great day. We'll see you again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ellen Dorfman, please come forward. Mr. Rao.
Thank you for your time and patience with all the people that have spoken before you. I think that some of the previous comments that have been made show exactly how much input has been given to you and the decisions you have made, while making some people unhappy, have made the majority of people happier. I have two issues I'd like to speak to today. One is the Grays Harbor situation. I agree with the commercial gill netter that spoke earlier that the hump tulips and the Chehalis River stocks need to be kept separate and monitored separately. My next point is that I agree 100% that this is an ongoing process and every year needs to be reviewed. One of the things that needs to be looked at is closing Area 2A to gill netters. The important reasons for this are twofold. Fish conservation is fresh water. We shouldn't have any gill netting in fresh water. Two, it's a negotiation tactic with the Quinault. We've heard testimony from commercial gill netters that have said that the Quinault will not fish simultaneously with them in Area 2A. And that's because it's a throttled down area in the river, as any of you who looks at the map will see. There's too many gill nets in that area to be fished effectively without constricting the flow of fish. The Quinault may be doing that for two reasons. Maybe they just don't like to fish with these guys in close quarters, but maybe they realize that not enough fish get through with that many people fishing simultaneously in a narrow freshwater area. That could be a way to bring the Quinault to the table for 4 days in and 3 days out, because when these guys fish, they won't fish that area, and they'll schedule another day that week to fish when they're not in that area. So there blows the 4 days in, 3 days out. But if you present it to them that way, they'll look at it as a cooperative measure. I'm sure that there's some reasonable heads over there that will agree with that and say, geez, yeah, then we can hold a three-day out and still give our people access to that area, which they have the rights to. Commercial people do not. My other thought is that I'm dealing with a completely different issue in Mason County. I'm in contact with Mark Downin, I believe your biologist in that area. Lake Nawatzel has a 14-inch limit. Two out of five fish are allowed to keep. Only two of them can be over 14 inches. The stocking program that has occurred in the last year or two has they've been putting in larger fish. 40 to 60% of the fish that Melanie and I catch, and we fish that lake predominantly through the winter, at least twice a month, three times a month. 40 to 60% of those fish are over 14 inches. Because of the stocking program, they put in 12 to 13 inch fish, and while I talked to Mark, this was not put in place to protect the larger fish that are put in March from Satsop Springs. They put in 4 to 8 pound fish that we help put in there. And that's not to protect them. That's to protect the fish that the state puts in. That needs to be changed, because at this point people have to stop fishing after two fish or three fish. And while using bait, any fish over 14 are effectively killed. And in the wintertime, that's what people fish with. So as a fish, you'll see more information on this, because I'm submitting data to him. And you'll see what I say, but there needs to be a rule change to either change it to 15 inches two fish over 15 or eliminate that. And there aren't that many big fish over 15 because we see that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Paul McMurtry. Okay, Ms. Dorfman.
Good morning. I'm changing the subject here and talking about wolves, not fish. Washington's protocol for killing wolves that have livestock depredation needs to be changed. Wolves in Washington are listed as endangered by both the federal and state government. They are just beginning to recover, and last year there were only 51 wolves, concentrated in the Northeast with 2 to 3 packs in the North Cascades. Any loss of wolves hurts our recovery efforts, and they're an essential part of the ecosystem. We found that herbivores will deprive lots of riparian habitat without wolves. Ranchers are compensated for livestock losses through federal and state funds, $10 surcharge on vanity license plates. We would like to have what Oregon has. Oregon State's livestock depredation protocol is wolves may be considered for removal. Livestock depredations occur on ranches, farms where non-lethal conflict measures are used. After 4 depredations during a 6-month period, then they considered removal. And the protocol is working in Oregon, not just for wolves, but for ranchers. In Washington, what they want to do is after 2 depredations during a year period or 6 month, they want to kill them. And we feel that Washington State needs to follow Oregon's model that promotes wolf recovery while minimizing livestock deprivation. And it has worked in Oregon. There are non-lethal methods. We don't have to go and slaughter them. It can be a win-win on both sides. Personally, nobody else is. You know, we graze livestock on public lands, and it costs taxpayers money. And I happen to be, my personal opinion is, we don't have a right to do that. It ruins a lot of the public lands, and we pay as taxpayers. And that, I know that's a federal thing, but that influences the difficulty with the wolves. And so that's my own personal opinion. But there are ways to do a win-win, and Oregon has proven it. So let's follow in their footsteps. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. McMurtry, go ahead.
I'd like to thank the Fish and Wildlife Commission for this opportunity to testify. I'd like to testify in favor of developing a wolf control policy that will allow the wolf population to continue to recover. I also advocate adopting a policy of wolf control, similar to the Oregon method, that is to have lethal measures after 4 depredations rather than 2 depredations in the state. I also would like to encourage the state to experiment and develop effective means of non-lethal means of avoiding the livestock deprivations, and also that ranchers that have that do experience unavoidable losses due to wolves should be compensated adequately. Thanks for this opportunity.
Thank you. We heard testimony yesterday from a number of people on this, on the protocol, the lethal removal protocol, and can I ask the director to respond? Because I think we need to clarify that it's a more complex picture than I think you have presented.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Thanks for your testimony this morning. And I would, I'm assuming you've read the protocols in their entirety, and you've read this section that's entitled Stipulation for Lethal Removals, which goes into a considerable level of detail under what conditions lethal removal would be considered, which is paints a much different picture, from my perspective at least, than just looking at the definition in that document. And so if you would make sure that you take a look at that, because it talks about 4 depredations within a smaller window of time, looking at it on a case-by-case basis as to whether or not non-lethal measures have been used and or whether there are other alternatives to lethal removal to address the problem. So the definition, where it, which is the 2 in 1 calendar year, can easily lead to a misconception about what our protocols are if you don't read that stipulation for lethal removal, which goes into more detail. So if you have, I'd ask you to read it again, and I would appreciate hearing back from you as to what your thoughts are after you read that particular sections of the protocols.
How would you get that?
If you leave me your name and contact number, email, whatever, I will get it to you. Matter of fact, I have it on my smartphone, and if I'm smart enough and you give me your email, I'll get it to you today.
Thank you. Thank you both. That concludes the open public input item. Oh.
I thought I signed up.
Why don't you come forward and introduce yourself and then sign the testimony sheet afterwards, because we'll need it.
Jerry Johnson. Good morning, commissioners, and I appreciate all your hard work. I know this is not easy at times. It's not easy for us either. I'd like to speak to the applications of admitted clopid and amazazon in the Willapa Bay. These permits with the Department of Ecology should be denied. Willapa is still one of the most pristine bays in Washington. Now its food chain, wildlife, crustaceans, fish, insects, and humans are being threatened by the application of insecticide and herbicide. These chemicals have no business in the estuary or any other. Killing off ghost shrimp and burrowing shrimp with imidacloprid will affect the quality of the seafood that is harvested in the Willapa. I emailed you the toxicology report, and it shows how many impacts it will have to the environment. The application of amazamox to kill off eelgrass and japonica will create many problems with the wildlife that depends on a healthy ecosystem. You cannot apply insecticides and herbicides without paying a price. The price is the health of the Willapa and everything that depends on it. Are we willing to go there? I understand the oyster growers' concerns. I was an orchard manager at one time and sprayed our orchard every year with pesticides. They don't solve the problems. I'd also like to speak to the wolf issue because it's kind of a passionate one for me. If you look at some of these states like Montana and look at the impacts that the elk herds have had and been devastated by it, and the mule deer populations, it's pretty self-explanatory what's going on there. They've destroyed those herds in a couple years' time. And we can't afford that in this state with our populations, which are a lot less. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Okay. And please do sign up, get a testimony form. And, okay. Great. Thank you. All right.